Alrighty. So we are in Colossians chapter 3, verse 22 through 4:1. It is Paul's instructions to for household members. And I will read this section. Did I say 22? I meant 18. 3:18 to 4:1. Third time's a charm, right? Okay. Paul writes, "Wives, submit to your husbands as is fitting in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and do not be harsh with them. Children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged. Slaves, obey in everything those who are your earthly masters, not by way of eye service as people pleasers, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, work heartily as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. For the wrongdoer will be paid back for the wrong he has done, and there is no partiality. Masters, treat your slaves justly and fairly, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." Okay. So obviously he's got three relationships in the home that he addresses here. Husband, wife, parent, child, master, slave. It's reprehensible to us, the last one. But we'll talk about that. I mean, as you can see, the very first question under that third section is by instructing the slaves to obey their masters in everything, does Paul give tacit approval of slavery? Why or why not? So I'm looking forward to your essays on that. Anyway, we are up on husband-wife relationship, and I wanted to see how we think through this whole idea of headship and submission by asking the question in the context of a difficult relationship. How does the wife submit when the husband is disobedient or an unbeliever? You know, it's one thing to sit and talk about what the words, the biblical concept of headship is, the biblical concept of submission is. But what's really going to test our understanding is, okay, let's take that and let's apply it to a tough situation. So what does it mean that you should do? And so that's what we did last week. I think we came up fairly unanimously on at least three major points. Three major points. She continues following Christ. She doesn't stop following Christ, doesn't stop obeying him. Clearly from 1 Peter 3, 1 and 2 that we brought into the picture, the husband and wife know each other's position. He knows she's a believer intent on following Christ. She knows he's in disobedience to the Lord. So clearly there's been some sort of exchange between the two. And so there should be. The whole point there is Peter's not saying that there shouldn't be any of that kind of conversation between the husband and wife. But clearly he's addressing a situation where that's happened. And so he's telling her, which was our third thing. So when it reaches the point, you know, where he's just said in this, you don't pressure him, but be quietly winsome in your testimony. You know, be at peace with him and all of that. And Seth pointed out last week that includes her not systematically resisting his leadership. That it shouldn't sour her on being inclined to follow his leadership. It's just that if he's unsaved and or disobedient, there's probably going to be times where she can't. That he's stepping out of the bounds of God-ordained headship. And that is when he's pushing her to do something that's disobedient to the Lord. She can't do that. And we shouldn't expect her to use submission as the reason to disobey the Lord. All right? Does that make sense? That's not in keeping with the biblical concept of submission. Paul here in verse 18 says, submit as is fitting in the Lord. In other words, this is what is appropriate. This is what God has designed in the marriage. So subtly, very subtly, that means submit as God has designed. Well, he didn't design submission to be an instrument for her to be led into sin. Okay? Ephesians 5 is even more clear. Submit to your husbands as unto the Lord. Okay? So that clearly implies submission doesn't involve following your husband into sin. Yeah, he was overwhelmed with the concept. But really, he did faint. It's funny, the pastor's up there reading Ephesians 5 at our wedding, and it's like he speeds up there at the end. I don't know why. He speeds up there at the end, and as soon as he finishes the last sentence in Ephesians 5, then you hear this, whomp, 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 her brother fell. I don't know if he had a premonition. He was trying to get it in before Tim fell or what. Anyway, that's a crack up. Okay. Now I'm totally got to regather my thoughts. Yeah. So, next question. Again, taking a tough situation and exploring the concept of headship here. You sensing a pattern here? We took the biblical concept of submission and said, okay, how does that apply to this? When a wife has an unsaved husband or a disobedient husband. Now we're taking the concept of headship and said, okay, what did Adam do wrong? What went wrong? Where did he fail in his headship? So you can turn to Genesis chapter 3 and see that in the first six verses here. Let me read those. Moses writes, "Now the serpent was more crafty than other beasts, than any other beast of the field that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, 'Did God actually say, you shall not eat any of the tree in the garden?' And the woman said to the serpent, 'We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden. Neither shall you touch it, lest you die.' But the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.' So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of the fruit of its fruit and ate. And then she went looking all over the place for Adam to try to find him, to get him to join in." Is that what the text said? No. Okay. She took of the fruit and ate, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her. And he ate. Okay. First of all, what is meant? What is biblical headship? Do you remember? Let me read the definition I gave you last week. I got this from Ray Ortland on the chapter he wrote in the book Recovering Biblical Manhood and Womanhood. I believe that's a great chapter by Ortland. I think this is one of the best definitions of biblical headship that I've ran into over the years. He, after doing his, going through his data, his scripture data and all of that, he comes to this conclusion. He says this is headship. This is his definition. Sorry, this is going to, I forgot to silence the beast. He defines headship this way: in this partnership of two spiritually equal human beings, man and woman, the man bears the primary responsibility to lead the partnership in a God-glorifying direction. You guys have notes? Okay. Does anybody need notes? So, right there's that definition. Let me read that again. He defines headship as this: in the partnership of two spiritually equal human beings, man and woman, the man bears the primary responsibility to lead the partnership in a God-glorifying direction. So, what exactly, in that definition, what exactly is the action of headship? What words would you point to in that definition that give the action of headship? Yeah, Carol? Would you? Lead? Yes. Responsibility? Does the woman bear any responsibility? Does she bear any responsibility in the partnership going in a God-glorifying direction? Carol's nodding yes. Yeah. So how does the husband's action differ from the wife's action?
Well, it's the leading
which means that he has primary responsibility. Doesn't mean the wife has no responsibility, right? Do you remember what helper means? What does helper mean? Yes. Yes. So the woman, the husband is the head, the woman is the strong helper. I like to call it strong helper. She brings her strength to the relationship and makes up for what's lacking in the man. So let me ask you this. If she refrains from doing that, how is that going to impact the direction of the partnership? Yeah, so she's lacking any input to register agreement or disagreement based on the merits of the situation. So does that just have a neutral effect on the husband? Yeah. Exactly. Doesn't give him opportunity to have another perspective. So what I'm saying is this. I think the keys here is that the husband bears the primary responsibility to lead the partnership in a God-glorifying direction. That really puts parameters on the concept of headship, doesn't it? It does not mean that the man dominates the woman, does it? No. It does not. So just real clear here. Male headship is radically different than male domination. I just want to get that out there. Okay? Because many times these days, those two things are equated. And it's not true. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of heads of families who feel that they've got the leeway to dominate. But male domination is radically different than the biblical concept, the divine design of male headship. Okay? But what it does mean, headship does mean that in the marriage, the man bears the primary responsibility to lead the partnership in a God-glorifying direction. See, now here's the other parameters. Here's the parameters. First of all, he's using the word partnership, right? So that implies male headship. What that says clearly is that male headship does not imply inequality between the genders, between the sexes. Doesn't mean woman's inferior. And remember, besides the woman, who else is called helper in the New Testament? I mean, in the Old Testament. God. Yeah. Psalm 33:20. You are my help, my shield. So clearly, helper does not imply inferiority. Thank you. Whew. So I think partnership, viewing the relationship as a partnership between two spiritually equal human beings, man and woman. And that it does not mean he gets no input, he gets no pushback, he gets none of that. Male headship does not include that. Male headship entails having the primary responsibility, but not the only say. Does that make sense? the parameters of the headship, the parameters of his responsibility is to lead the partnership in a God-glorifying direction. Hence, what we were talking about in that first question, submission on the woman's part does not mean that she has to follow her husband into sin. Because the response, what the concept of biblical headship is the husband is treating his wife as a spiritual equal, but he's taking the initiative, as Seth said, taking the primary responsibility to lead the partnership in a God-glorifying direction, not in a sinful direction, not in a God-rebelling direction. Okay? So, tell me, what happened in Genesis 3? What happened there? How did Adam fail in his headship? Say that again. Yeah? He stood passively by. What could he have done? Pam says he could have suggested that she not eat the fruit. He was with her, right? That's
yeah. Did she know? Had she been created when God told Adam not to eat that fruit?
Well, that's an interesting question. Pam asks, "Does God was she created when God told them not to eat the fruit?" In the text, in Genesis chapter 2, that mandate comes in verse 9, I think it is. Oh, yeah. 9 just says that the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil was there in the garden. 16. And the Lord commanded the man, saying that you may eat of every tree of the garden, but the tree of the knowledge of the good and evil you shall not eat, for in it, the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. So Pam asks the good question. In Genesis 3:6, doesn't even have to be Genesis 3:6, did Adam, was Eve created when God gave those instructions to Adam? According to the biblical text, no. Now, does that mean they were never repeated to her? She quotes it, exactly. So, yes, she does. She does. She does add it. God never told him that you cannot touch it or you'll die. He says you cannot eat of it. But you laugh, but what evangelical those that hold, evangelicals that hold that there's no difference in roles, that equality in Christ means equality or sameness of role, that they go to this very question that Pam asked. And they said that 1 Timothy 2, for instance, 11 through 14, I do not permit a woman to instruct a man or exercise authority over a man. And then Paul bases that, and the context there is in the church meeting, in the church assembly. I do not permit a woman to have an ongoing ministry of teaching men, nor exercising authority over men in the assembly meeting. And then he bases it on the fall, on creation and the fall. Paul cites that evidence. And so here's what many will say. That was necessary back when women were uneducated. And they'll go back to Genesis 2 and 3 and cite the fact that God gave the command to Adam before Eve was created, and cite her addition to the creation and say, see, this is just kind of a paradigm or an example of the woman not being equal as far as education and whatnot as the man. When in our modern society where women are equal with men in that regard, it doesn't apply. That is a position seriously held by evangelicals. So it's not a frivolous question. Right.
In other words, he had given the information.
Right.
And now the information is tested right in his face and he's not doing it.
Yeah. What could he have done in addition to suggesting there to his wife that she doesn't need it?
Grab that snake out of the tree.
Yes, he could have intervened into the conversation, right? Could have intervened into the conversation and spoken to the snake directly. But he didn't. And he didn't even suggest to his wife that they don't need it. He just stood there. I mean, that's pretty amazing. See, this whole conversation there. She takes it and eats it. And then gives it to her husband who was with her. So, let me say this. When it comes to headship, it doesn't mean that we're always right. Doesn't mean that we have all the answers. Doesn't mean that our wives can't be brighter, wiser, more insightful, and all of that than us. It simply means that we say, let's do this more times than she does. That's taking the initiative. Does that make sense? Did you have any other comment or question? Yeah, he might have also refrained from blaming her to God. they were all blaming her, except for the snake. He looked down and all there was is dirt. Yes. Right.
Scripture doesn't say we are all in Adam and Eve. We are
right.
All in Adam. But both of them sinned, right?
Right.
So, and she ate first.
Yeah.
So she actually sinned first.
She did.
What if Adam hadn't taken it
off? And you know, I heard a question like that in Fiddler on the Roof. In the song, and it says it's questions that can cross a rabbi's eyes. I don't know. I don't know what would have happened. Yeah. So for the benefit of those listening to the tape, two questions have been asked. One was, so did Eve sin too? Because we're charged with the guilt of Adam's sin, not Eve's sin. So was it sin on Eve's part? And if so, then she was the first, she committed the first sin. And the answer is yes on both of those. Yes, she sinned. Yes, that was the first sin. First human sin. Yes, there was a devilish sin. Many of them. Lucifer rebelled and took a third of the angelic host with him. And then Carol asked, because Carol's just ornery this way. Carol asked, what if Adam didn't sin? What if he didn't follow into it? Then what? Pardon? Yes, but still, she would have corrupted her own nature. No, I think simply what it is is this, that God set up Adam as the representative. Adam, he's just spouting Romans 5. Adam, God set up Adam as the representative of mankind. So he is our covenant head. And he was our covenant head. And he failed in his probation. And so since he was our representative, we were charged with his sin. He was our representative, not Eve. Now, obviously, I think the reason that he was the representative and not Eve is due to the roles that God built into male and female. Man's the head, woman's the strong helper, who puts a little competence into the man. That's just a joke.
Isn't this where the term Adam's sin being high-handed?
Yeah. Big-bellied sin. Right.
And say, yes. This is
yes.
The direction we're going.
Yes. His Adam's sin was self-serving. It was in total disregard to the descendants that he was representing, it was self-serving in the sense that he didn't have to disagree with his wife, and he didn't have to get in an argument with a snake. You can make all kinds of comments about that last thing, not wanting to get in an argument with a snake. So it was self-serving in that way, totally self-serving, just looking to his own desires in the moment. Now, how did man corrupt themselves? They were righteous. They were holy. It was creaturely holiness, okay? It wasn't infinite holiness. It wasn't God's holiness or God's righteousness. It's creaturely righteousness, which means it can change. It's changeable. Here's the neat thing about salvation. And there's several things I didn't say this morning. I wish I would have. Here's one of the neat things about salvation. When we are justified before God, we are given credit for Christ's righteousness. That's not a creaturely righteousness. Salvation doesn't simply put us back to where we were before Adam fell. Doesn't put us back in the garden in Adam's situation. Okay? It puts us in God's family. It puts us in the inner circle with the Trinity. We are given Christ's righteousness, which is not a creaturely righteousness. So that's pretty cool, isn't it? And that's so that's not changeable. Carol, I can just see the question. I mean, it's all over the face. Right, right. Now, right, right. So, you know, and you can have all kinds of conversations here. Okay, so how does valid moral agency, that is human freedom, meet God's sovereignty in issues like this, or any issue rather, but this is a real clear issue. What if Eve would have sinned and Adam didn't? It was necessary for Adam to sin in order for all of salvation to take place. Right.
We could use the same argument to say, well, what if Judas right. betrayed Jesus? What if, you know, any series of events that led up to the cross didn't
yeah.
take place? I mean, it had to happen.
Well, here's what we have to answer. Here's the way I have to answer that question. We can go down the road a little bit, some a little further down the road than others, in seeing how human freedom and divine sovereignty don't contradict each other. But in the end, you hit the wall of mystery where you can't penetrate. You just know that God isn't running roughshod over his creatures. And that's one thing I keep telling myself. I can get down the road a little bit and show that there's not a logical contradiction here. But to be able to mentally put it all together and show how it all just fits in all of its details, no, nobody can do that. That's shrouded in mystery. But you can go down the road a little bit and show that you're not dealing with logical absurdity and logical contradiction. Here's the other thing that I like to keep in mind, and that is, what is freedom? What is human freedom, free will? Well, the will is the mind inclining to one thing over against another. That's what the mind... Free will is the mind choosing according to its own desires. Okay? And that's the way we tick. That's the way God made us. He made us. He gave us the freedom of choosing according to our own desires. And so the problem when Adam and Eve fell, the problem is, as they stood there and they contemplated this temptation from the snake, from the serpent. He actually had legs at that time. And as they contemplating eating it, they were being lured toward the bait, and they're contemplating eating it. As they went through that process and decided to do it, they corrupted their nature. We all come from them, so we inherit their corrupt nature. And so now, whereas Adam and Eve had the, in their natural state, had the freedom to not sin as well as the freedom to sin, we, in our fallen state, an unredeemed state, don't have the freedom to not sin. Why? Is it a physical incapacity? No. It's a moral incapacity. We don't want to not sin. Does that make sense? I know that entails a double negative there. We do not want to not sin. We want to sin. We love it. We're willing slaves because that's the way we tick. We make our choices. We choose according to our desires. Well, our desires are corrupt now. So all of our choices are going to be corrupt. Does that make sense? So then when we're redeemed, sin's tyranny is broken. We still have corrupt desires. But Paul says in Romans 6, they shall not reign as king over you. They shall not rule over you. Now, that verb for rule is reign as a king. That shall, sin shall not reign as a king over you. I had no idea we were going to be in Romans 6 tonight. But anyway, so it's not that they lost the freedom to choose according to their desires. It's their desires became corrupt at the fall. Our desires became corrupt at the fall. And so we are willing slaves to sin. That's all we want now because our desires are corrupt. But anyway, I don't know how we got that far down the road. But would you say? No. So clearly, what Adam did was he failed to intervene and to try to steer the relationship, the partnership, in a God-glorifying direction. Step in, choke the snake, grab his wife, and run. Okay? So then that next question, how might Paul's instructions to the husband have transformed the Roman practice of male headship? Did you guys take a crack at that at all? Yes. Yes, it is. And here's something that you may not pick up reading through 3:18-4:1 because you, or even reading through Ephesians 5, but because you probably haven't read ancient household codes from Roman and Greek times. But if you do, what is so different about Paul's instructions here in Colossians isn't the relationships he's addressing, husband, wife, parent, child, master, slave. But there is, just the way he set it up there, there is a pattern of reciprocity throughout that whole thing. And what I mean by that is, he says, wives, submit to your husbands. But husbands, you love your wives and don't be harsh to them. Children, obey your parents in everything. That's very sweeping, by the way. That's quite extensive. Children, obey your parents in everything. But parents, fathers in particular, don't frustrate them so that you send them into despair of ever pleasing their parents. Slaves, obey your masters in everything. But masters, you make sure you treat them fairly and equitably, justly and fairly. So there's rest, you know, there's instructions to the person that's in the submissive role, whether it's wife, parent, children, or slaves. And I'm not equating those three, okay? He requires a reciprocal behavior with respect to their role from the husband, father, master. So you see that back and forth, real simple. You don't see, when you go back and read ancient household codes like that, you don't see that. It's instructions. If there's instructions to the head of the household, is get control. And normally that's what it is. You don't even see them addressing. Sometimes they do, but you normally don't even see them addressing the kids. Here, Paul addresses them directly before he addresses the parents. And so there's reciprocal behavior that he instructs the members of the household with. So we're used to it. We don't know what the ancient codes are, but in Paul's day, it's eye-opening. You read through that, and there's this pattern of reciprocity. What is this man doing? He should give up his man card. So, anyway. Yes, so. Now, so yes. Man, the head of household, in Paul's, listening to Paul's instructions, wouldn't be harsh, would be focused on loving his wife, and that would have absolutely transformed the practice of the Roman practice of male headship. Okay, now, that second question. As in the first two verses, 18 and 19, to wives and husbands, Paul addresses the people with less authority in the relationship first. So he's done that in both relationships. Wife and husband, child and parent. He addresses the person with the less authority in the relationship first. And the author points out, in doing this, he treats them as morally responsible persons, acknowledging their dignity and worth. Like I said, ancient codes, you don't see them doing that. So this just isn't nice sounding words meant to stroke those with less authority. This is not what he's doing here. He's saying, you read those codes. This is different, what Paul's doing. He addresses the people with less authority in the relationship first. In so doing, he treats them as morally responsible persons, acknowledging their dignity and worth. Echoing Old Testament instruction, And then I put in parentheses here, not Roman culture, and referred you to Exodus 20:12 and Deuteronomy 5:16. Echoing Old Testament instruction, Paul instructs children to honor the authority of their parents. That is, respect and obey them. So, in verse 20, Paul, I'm back in Genesis 3. In verse 20, Paul writes, children, obey your parents in everything, for this pleases the Lord. What reason or motivation does Paul give for this obedience? Pleases the Lord, yeah. And literally what it says, this is puzzling to me. Literally it says, this is pleasing in the Lord. Every Bible translation, just about every Bible translation has, it pleases the Lord. Some variant of that, it pleases the Lord. Almost every commentator commenting on the Greek says, it's actually saying it's pleasing in the Lord, indicating that it's pleasing in the community, Christian community. So I'm wondering, why doesn't the exegesis get into the translation, or is there some other middle ground here? I'm sure if I did more research, I can find an answer to that. But yes, it's pleasing in the Christian community, and obviously also to the Lord, even though he may or may not state that directly there. His emphasis might be, it's pleasing and fitting in the Christian community for kids to obey their parents. That's the motivation there, that you're that you are pleasing the Christian community by acting in a way that God designed for you to act. But, and then certainly that would please the Lord as well. So yes, that's the motivation that he lays out there. Here's a question for you. That second question in verse 21. How does Paul's instructions to fathers and mothers ensure that the children's compliance will not be abused or taken advantage of? And as a follow-up to that, as parents, how do we practice that in instruction? By the way, I put in parentheses and mothers, or maybe the author did, I don't know. But in verse 20, children, obey your parents. The Greek word that's translated parents is, that's the only way it can be translated, is parents. Then in verse 21, fathers. The word that's translated fathers, it's primarily translated fathers, but it can also be referring to both parents. It can be parents. It can at times be translated parents. I think it's in Hebrews chapter 11, I think somewhere in the 20s, where the author of Hebrews talks about Moses' parents rescued him. Forget exactly how the wording goes, but the word that's used for, that's translated parents there in Hebrews 11, is the exact same word that's translated here in Colossians 3:21 as fathers, and in Ephesians 6:4 as fathers. Same word. So it's not... it's not wrong to say this is instruction to mothers too. All right? I went through all of the explanation just to say that. This just isn't trying to bring you in on my own responsibility. This is the word itself can be translated parents. It's more normally translated fathers, but it's big enough to include parents if the writer wants to use it that way. Okay? Does that make sense? Yes, no, maybe so. So, how does Paul's instructions ensure that the children's obedience won't be abused or taken advantage of? That's kind of a sneaky way of wording it, isn't it? You know what it's doing? It's taking Paul's instructions to the fathers and turning it around to the perspective of the children. Right? What's he tell the fathers not to do? Yes, he tells the fathers not to frustrate. From the child's perspective, that word frustrate, that concept of frustrating our children, has the idea of being harsh and demanding, inflexible, and all of that. So coming across is just this inflexible, harsh person that doesn't think about the kids, just throwing out demands and all of that. And so from the children's perspective, it can be like, well, I'm told to comply with that guy, but I feel like I'm being taken advantage of here. Right? Does that make sense? Right. Right. Yeah, it's translated various ways. The idea there is to embitter them or bring them into despair of ever being able to please their parents. In other words, they're never able to wipe the parental frown off the parent's face. They never see the parental smile. That's the way one commentator put it, an old commentator put it. But anyway, so how does Paul's instruction ensure that that doesn't happen? Well, he's telling them, don't do it. Don't be inflexible. Don't be demanding. Yes, you're the authority. Yes, parents need to set the authority in the home. The goal from birth isn't to be your kid's best friend. That's the ultimate goal down the road. But you know that they need to be able to arrange themselves under authority. And so that's your task, right? Especially those first few years, is to bring them under authority. But like Paul says in 1 Timothy 3, you got to do it with dignity. And this is what he's telling fathers here. And by the way, children, this could be older children, and many argue that it is, just simply because he's directly addressing them. But it's probably a range. It's probably children that are just old enough to be able to receive this type of instruction, but it can go up into older children too, because the families were extended back then. It's not like American families where, you know, our society is very atomistic. I mean, we just divide up. You know, everybody goes everywhere. I remember when I was stationed in the Philippines for 2 years, very clannish. Families stuck together. Many of them lived together. And all of that. So you would have older kids like that in the home. The real question is, how do you practice this? What does that entail? How should we go about ensuring that we're frustrating or provoking our children in the sense of causing them to despair of ever pleasing mom and dad? Sure. Right. Right. So it's definitely, it drives us to the Lord to be praying, to be leaning on Him, trusting Him. And so then, when we get off our knees and we go out and we interact on a daily basis with our kids, what are some of the things we need to do in order to ensure that we're not taking advantage of God's instruction to our children to obey your parents? Yeah. Which, yes.
I would say also to have patience, because when it says children obey your parents, kids are going to slip up a lot. So having patience and mercy, not saying, you messed everything up, you are a terrible kid.
Oh, yes.
Continue to have forgiveness.
Yes, that's, Ian brings up very, very important issue, and that is the way that parents talk to their kids and the guilt trips they put on their kids. Kids are sinners. Guess where they got their sin nature? And and all the wise are saying the man did it. But anyway, they're sinners. And so many times, people respond by putting those kind of guilt trips on kids that Ian just messed up. You just ruin everything. And all that. I can't remember all that you said. So Ian is saying, we need to have patience. We need to consider they're sinners too, and they're going to mess up. And that is very true. Here's one thing that, you know, Pam and I became convinced of, I don't know, it might have been later on when we were in the, I don't know, I'm not even going to try to. Anyway, one of the things that I'm convinced of, that we're convinced of, is that we need to use times of disobedience, we need to see those as opportunities to take the kids to the cross. Now, that doesn't mean that you sit them down and you go through a long lecture on human depravity and on the incarnation and life and death and resurrection of Christ and the gospel. Okay, that's not what I'm talking about. But the reason they have trouble with obeying is the same reason we have trouble with obeying, is that they've got sin desires. So it's an opportunity to tell, to let our children know, to talk to them about the fact that, yes, here's why you have a problem with obeying mom and dad. It's because you, just like your mom and dad, is a sinner, are a sinner. You are a sinner. And you take it to that. So if you use it as an opportunity to take them to the cross, then it's not, then it doesn't become the battle of pride that Seth was talking about. You you are violating the family name. You are spitting in my face and walking all over my authority. It doesn't become that kind of a standoff with your kids. It's like, yes, we are both sinners. We both have problems with obedience. And so you use it as an opportunity to take them to the cross. So let me ask this, just to tag, and then we're going to have to stop here. But I got to just tag on to what Ian said here. She said, we parents do this, where they'll say, you make everything terrible. You're so, you know, so on and so forth. What are other things that we do that are not the same thing, but are similar? How do we treat our, what are other things that we do? What about talking about our kids in a negative way to other adults with an earshot of them? Do we do that? What are other things?
Comparing them. Why can't you be like your sister?
Yes, very good. Comparing them. Why can't you be like your sister? That sort of thing. You see, this is what's so countercultural in Paul's day. Head of household never had to worry about that sort of stuff. You just laid the law down. So, anyway, very incredibly important instructions. I love that reciprocity in Paul's approach to these household relationships. Let's stop here. Seth, you want to close us?